哎，挂了，是这样。
Okay, as you know, the format for the rest of the afternoon is the show and tell format. You've got 15 minutes to talk about anything you want. Show things, pictures, whatever. We've got more than enough people to actually fill in the time. So we're just going to keep going until everyone leaves. Right? So if you want to talk about anything individually, try and keep your questions to a minimum and try and nail the person after the session finishes. Okay? Okay, first up, we've got Tim Antle.
Well, my talk's going to be rather short because I had a little bit of a problem over the Christmas break. Everything shut down, so I wasn't able to get my boards produced in time to come and show you. As part of my university courses, I'm designing a device to interface telephones to computers via USB. This isn't a very new topic. The Digman devices do this. You can buy a $100 little device. Where the challenge comes from is I'm trying to produce an 8-line device for sale of about $150 Australian. So in the end of my project, I hope to have a commercially produced device which you can buy for $150 Australian that will let you interface 8 telephones to a computer, which is well below any other device I could see on the market at the moment. All the stuff I'm doing will be open source, so you'll be able to download the schematics and produce the device yourself. You can get samples for almost all the chips you want, so the only cost is really producing the PCB if you want to do it at home. I'm building a very modular design. What I have built and what I will show you today is my telephone interface module, which is a little chip that comes about this size. It basically has a subscriber line interface chip, and you have a digital interface on one side, and you supply it with 40 volts, and it does all your hard stuff about telephones. If you've never looked at telephones, you'll find that they only have two lines to connect to your telephone, which you have to receive and send on, which makes life quite difficult when you're extracting the audio and sending the audio back out, because you have to impedance match and a lot of these things. This little device, which I'll pass around, will do all that for you. They cost about $12 to non-mass produce. Mass produce, they cost about $3. So my device is based around these things. Please be kind about the soldering job. This was my first attempt at doing surface mount soldering. So obviously, these would be reflow soldered if I was getting them made commercially. But for prototypes, hand soldering is all I've got available. So the way I'm cutting costs of this device is by using a PIC microcontroller as the center or core of my device. This means that none of the voice processing, like turning into VoIP and stuff like that, is done on chip. It's all done in your computer. The device is really just a glorified analog to digital, digital to analog converter with a bunch of extra stuff so you can ring your telephone. I plan to interface with Asterix, and my honors project finishes mid this year, so it will be done by then before I have a deadline. I've also got an Ethernet model which uses a PIC microprocessor with the inbuilt Ethernet controller, but you still need a computer to interface because it ships the raw audio frames via Ethernet. Doesn't support TCP/IP or anything like that. Just basically you get a frame, Ethernet frame type audio. So it's very low cost device to produce and make. The USB one is almost exactly the same design, except instead of having an Ethernet interface, you have a USB interface. I'd highly recommend, if anybody's interested in interfacing to computers, have a look at the Microchip PIC series, especially the 18F. The older processors like the 16F are less powerful and don't have as good interfacing capabilities. And the best thing about it, Microchip will ship you free samples. Microchip. They make the PIC processor. They'll ship you free samples of almost all their lines. They'll ship you, I've also got another thing to demonstrate. This is a little Vera board, if nobody's seen, if people haven't seen this before. It's good for prototyping stuff, and I've got a little test device. This is another device that I hope to produce at the end. It's a little USB PIC module. It's powered by USB. You basically plug it in, and you get a whole bunch of I.O. lines, which you can connect to any device you feel like. Like, if you want to build a bunch of LEDs, you can interface with a bunch of LEDs. Pardon? Either. There's 8 analog lines, and there's, well, there's 8 analog outputs, and there are 8 analog inputs on the same pins, and the rest are digital. So, and you've got an SPI interface if you want to interface to some type of, I don't know, temperature sensor or external memory. This one here is currently configured to be a keyboard and mouse, so when you plug it in, it writes foobar continually and twirls your mouse in a circle. It's an interesting little one, so I'll pass this around. Well, these will be produced for about $12. They have about 12 supporting components if you include connectors. That's the really brilliant thing about these microchips. You can get a PIC, you need an oscillator, 2 capacitors, and a connector, and you have a USB interface. I'll pass around this little Vera board as well. This is the same type of thing, but it uses a DIP PIC. So if you want to do it on breadboard, it works fine at low speed on breadboard, and they'll ship you these for free, these little chips here for free. So if you want to play around with it, I'd highly recommend signing up and getting 6 or 7 of these chips. They let you do 3 orders a month. I don't think I've gone through a month without ordering at least something from them. The Ethernet one is slightly more complicated, but if you have any old Ethernet cards around, you can steal most of the components you need from them. Well, a lot of the places will ship you free samples as long as you're honest about what you're doing with them. Like, if you say, look, I'm going to produce 10 million units, and then they ring you up and you, like, 6 months later and you say, no, I was only actually producing 1, they tend to put you on a blacklist. But if you're producing anything within 1,000 units, I'm quite happy to ship you samples. You can also buy samples for about $8 a chip, which is really quite cheap. I don't know anywhere like Dick Smith, Tandy, J-Car don't sell the PIC, the USB PIC variety. They do? They didn't a month and a half ago. So I'd highly recommend getting one of these if you want to do any type of audio interface. This is just a Vera board example, so you can have a look at that as well.
Quick interruption. Yep. I think with our time we've got audio working, it seems they actually want to record the questions as well.
Yeah. Is there a question?
Yeah, stick your hand up and wait until the mic comes in.
So if you've got any questions about doing this interfacing or general questions about my honors project, feel free to ask.
What's your development environment?
What's your development environment under Linux or you know, 4.4?
I currently have a PIC programmer from ASIC, which is actually a quite a good device, which is actually up in my bag back there.
So you're actually putting in like an EEPROM programmer type concept?
There's a little EEPROM program I have to load firmware first time. I haven't got around to writing a USB bootloader. Once I've done that, then you just load it on once and you never have to, in theory, you'll never have to interface with a programmer again unless you overwrite the bootloader because there's no way to externally protect it. Under Linux, I use Vim for my editing. I write in PIC-ASM. There's about 32 instructions and quite easy to remember, kind of logical sounding ones rather than x86, which has got a bazillion instructions and they have all these weird things they do and different register sets. So it's quite easy, and sometimes when at uni I use a thing called MPLAB, which is a free piece of software, as in being, not as in your freedom. So that you can get off the Microchip website and you just download it, and sadly it's a Windows program. It's not particularly good, but for doing, Microchip have a lot of kind of demonstration code on their website, and to build that you need the MPLAB, so that's what I use that for.
There is a free software PIC assembler as well.
The GPASM.
I've used that, it's been pretty reasonable.
I've used that for compiling ASM code. Basically, it's a drop-in replacement for the Microchip version, and it's about 99.5% compatible. That's good to use under Linux. You can build a programmer for a PIC using another PIC for about $8. So I don't have a website yet, but within the next 2 or 3 months, I'll have a website at my URL, which I'll write up on the board somewhere.
We can post up on the Wiki.
I'll write up on the board as well, and the Wiki.
Yep.
And from... we don't have any chalk.
Okay,
it'll be on the Wiki. There we go. Yeah, this is high tech. Okay, so that's my domain, and I'll have information for purchasing the little USB, that one here. I'll have information for how to purchase the version 2 of that. That's a prototype, doesn't use proper solder mask or anything like that, so it won't look like that. It will look like the little interfaces that I'm passing around in terms of how proper solder mask, and it will be soldered by professionals rather than me. So it will be much better. Any other last questions before I come and sit down?
One quick little question. A lot of the analog, the telephone line interface devices have real big problems with echo and all these sorts of things. And I've always wondered why that is, and maybe you can...
Well, it's because most of the devices do echo cancellation in a piece of hardware that can only really deal with one type of echo. So when you start bringing that up to VoIP, you start getting different echo latencies because of the way VoIP works and stuff like that. So I don't actually do any echo cancellation hardware. It's all done in software. There's some quite good libraries out there that will help you do echo cancellation, and Asterisk has a really nice plugin for some really good echo cancellation. And it's actually advantageous to do the echo cancellation in software, because when you try and do it in hardware and software, you kind of get feedback loops which go and destroy your voice quality. So that's my solution to the problem. It also means that the software for the device is significantly cheaper to produce, which is what I'm trying to do. Produce a very cheap way to interface the whole house to an Asterisk box.
That's the last one, okay?
I was just wondering whether you've looked at RF and PIC, so Bluetooth and PIC and stuff like that.
I haven't done any RF and with PIC for the simple reason that that's the only line of PICs that you can't get. Microchip will produce a version of PIC called RF PIC, which has an inbuilt RF amp and all this the nice stuff that you want to do when you're doing RF. So you just connect an antenna to two pins. But you can't get samples for that one, and they don't think they actually even sell us anymore. So other than that, I haven't really had time to look at it. I've been too busy trying to get my project done.
Okay, that's it for the game. One quick comment. Tim is doing the gaming mini conference tomorrow.
Yes, please come along.
Yay.
Can I have the things back that I sent out, please? Yeah. Somebody attached it to me.
Thank you.
Is that too much?
Oh, we should have tried this beforehand.
Oh, it's time to use it. There are other people here.
Yeah. Do you want to pick it up?
It'll put a channel. He's just jealous. It's all about size, so I've been told.
Oh, right.
I'm starting to feel like the Donald. Let me, while they try and make that work, how about I... But yeah, that's why I thought I'd start talking anyway.
Oh, I didn't know. I'll just get to know you can.
Yep.
May slide off the best
thing. It'll be alright. It's insured.
Yes, I think I'd be able to give you dinner.
My name's Andrew Kinmont. I'm from Sage Consultants in Brisbane. Sage is, we believe, the largest independent electronic product development company in Brisbane. There are a lot of other development teams which are actually bigger than us. However, we are independent in so much that we don't actually develop our own products, we actually develop products for other people. So people will come to us and say, we want a widget developed, and we go, yeah, what colour, you know, all that sort of stuff that people ask when they're developing a new product, and we develop that product for them. Our experience is quite broad. If we were to actually look at what is our core competency, we would say our core competency is in embedded 32-bit microcontroller applications. We have experience with ColdFire, MIPS, and most of the Xscale platforms, so PXA255, 270, and the IXP425 families. I've brought along today and hopefully now things are going to start working for me. I'm plugged in. Well, I'll just keep. No, I don't know. Technology. Where's an engineer when you need one? Oh, I'm getting very, very. My laptop.
Video.
Is the projector on?
You need to do something like pop the external.
Yeah, they're like a function.
Oh, it could be.
Yeah. Hey, don't take pictures now, it's fucking up.
Yeah,
That should be. Yeah, that's it. Okay, let me talk about some of the challenges while the guys make it all work. The product that I'm going to hopefully be demonstrating for you in a moment is a product that we developed for a company in Brisbane called Auslog. Auslog are actually involved with borehole logging for mainly for things like artesian basin type stuff and things like that. And one of the things that they wanted to be able to do, you can play there if you wish to make it work. One of the things that they wanted to be able to do was to actually view the inside of a borehole. They had an existing system that was capable of monitoring to about 300 metres depth in colour and 500 metres depth in black and white. But they were looking for a system that would log to a depth of 2,000 metres. The challenge, of course, is that video signals don't transmit very well over the cable, particularly the type of cable that they were using. And to be able to get to 2,000 metres, we need to come up with something that was a little bit more, something better. So the approach that we took, are we getting any closer? The approach that we took, we might switch to something else in a moment. The approach that we actually took was to think, well, okay, we can get digital communications which can operate over those sorts of distances, and we were looking particularly at the variants of DSL and the types, you know, the various types of DSL technology. ADSL, for example, is up to some fairly high data rates now and over quite long distances. We ultimately settled on SHDSL. The main reason that we did was because when you think about the application, we're trying to put a high-speed device down a hole, and we want the high-speed link coming up to the surface. We're trying to feed a video signal or a high-speed signal from something that's 2,000 metres underground back up to the surface. ADSL actually works completely the wrong way around. If you think about implementing the DSL modem or ADSL modem at the down in the hole, because then your high-speed link is actually going down and your low-speed link is coming up, which means that you'd then have to implement basically the equivalent of an exchange, or the DSLAM interface at least in the exchange, down in a device that had to fit in a tube that was 43 millimetres in diameter. So we then decided to move to SHDSL, which gives you symmetrical or symmetric communication speeds. And we did some initial testing and managed to get to 2.3 megabits per second bidirectional over, I think we got to 2,500 metres before it all got a bit sad. Is it still a bit sad? We could do it on somebody else's laptop, maybe.
Okay.
Just get another laptop going. Right. I was going to show you a picture of it actually coming out of the camera, but I'll just talk about it because it's really, really good.
You give me the picture, and I'll start that on the website.
Yeah. It looks a lot better on the demo. I can tell you that. Can I show you the award that we got for it? So in essence, we implemented a PXA270 core, which was Intel's core, now is Marvell's core, running at 520 megahertz. It runs full Linux, so we've got the full version, not the, the MMU-less version. 2.4.21 kernel is actually running on this platform. 64 meg both of flash and RAM. We've got an MPEG-4 encoder, which we've done in software. And then it communicates out through the SHDSL backend to a stock standard SHDSL modem which sits at the surface. As I said, the thing got an award, and I even brought it, because it's always good for show and tell, if nothing else. It won the EDN award for the best use of the microcontroller last year. I brought another product which is actually a little bit better to look at, which it looks like because that one's not interesting anymore. It's basically a PD. It's basically a PDA on steroids. This has just been released into the market, so I'm allowed to talk about it now. We developed this for Thomas and Betts, and they're using it basically as an interface to monitor emergency exit lights in large installations. So a place like the university or a large commercial building would have a bunch of these ultimately installed in them. The reason it looks kind of odd for a PDA, in that the screen's that big and the keyboard's that big, is because it has some provision for some custom communications modules to do things like LongWorks type interface, which is a common wired interface into exit signs. Also Zigbee networks, which they're now implementing into a lot of the new exit signs. And it gives them the ability to be able to monitor the exit sign, make sure that it's alive. They can run automated tests to make sure the batteries are still working, those sorts of things. This product has just been entered in the Australian Design Awards for this year. So if you go to the Australian Design Awards website, you'll see the submission for it now.
I think that means vote for me.
Was it that blatant? I have a small pile of business cards here just in case you need to. Since I couldn't actually show you the pretty pictures, because I was very glad that we had had one of the 10% sitting in the front row, because I was going to flip the camera over the edge, but I'm sorry you didn't get to be on the big screen. So has anybody any questions? I know I didn't actually show you anything running. The board will be at the show and tell, because I'm going to trust Mark at least with that. Open day, I beg your pardon. It was designed, obviously one of the constraints was it had to fit down a very small hole, so it had to be designed to fit inside a 43mm diameter stainless steel tube. This is an 8-layer printed circuit board. It was actually made in Australia, including the assembly of the BGA components which are on it, so it can actually be done in Australia. I'm not trying to contradict what other people are saying, but it can actually be done. Yes, we did. It was done by a company, and I'm not going to get any commission for this, a company called Precision Circuits in Melbourne. And the loading of the BGA components was done by Startronics in Sydney, in case you needed to know that as well. All of the intelligent work was done in Brisbane. Making circuit boards and loading components, whilst it's very valuable, only serves to make us look better. So, yes. I'm sorry, so are there any questions? I'm available for high, sorry.
So I always thought exit lights were just lights.
There is an Australian standard which requires that all of the lights be tested at regular intervals, mainly because, you know, if the power goes off, they want to be sure that the exit light actually works. So they have to be tested every 6 months. Somebody has to have done a test. Basically. So it's to make sure that the batteries are actually okay and the light actually works, the bulb hasn't blown. But into all of the modern designs, all the modern signs, all of that is automated. So it can be done automatically without somebody having to wander around to every single sign and say, yes, it's working. In a large installation, it's nothing to have a couple of thousand of those signs in a big multi-storey building. It's an expensive job if you've got somebody walking around. Any other questions?
The circuit boards for your camera down the hole, when your micro BGAs ultimately fail from going up and down the hole, who reworks those?
The board hasn't been designed to be reworked. And to be honest with you, BGAs are actually one of the more reliable packages. It's the ones that are more likely to fail are the fine pitch flat packs, not the BGAs. The BGA process is actually one of the more reliable manufacturing processes. These boards have only been built in batches of 10 and 12. So it isn't large volume. However, this one here, we've already built 120 of those, even though it hasn't been formally released. But we've got products that have been built in batches of 3,000 to 5,000, all with BGAs, and it's not the BGAs that cause the problems. It's the other components. They're a pain to work with for prototyping, but as far as reliability on a circuit board, we've not had any problems. This product here is running the latest version of the 2.6 kernel. The main reason we stuck with 2.4 on that one, when we were actually, that product was actually developed nearly 2 years ago, so it has been around for a little while. That's one of the main reasons why it's still at the 2.4 kernel. But also, we were the first ones in Australia to get one of Intel's development boards. We're talking about the development process. That product, the borehole camera, was developed completely in 7 months from the moment of concept to the point where the prototypes were given to the customer was 7 months. The hardware and the software developed in parallel by using one of the Intel development boards. We were the first ones in Australia to get hold of one of those. And at the time, Intel had the 2.4.21 kernel with the patches to make it go, as well as the full tool chain ready to go. So once we had it running, there was no compelling reason to move from that version of the kernel.
More about things like the real-time performance and
Yeah. The serious real-time stuff is, like, for all of the communications was offloaded into, you know, if you'd have seen the picture, I would have shown you. He's standing in the corner now. The logic chip that actually offloaded the really hard real-time stuff, all of the video stuff was done using DMA, and the actual encoding of video stream wasn't that time-consuming, and that wasn't that hard real-time. So the hard real-time stuff was done either with DMA or hardware, so we really didn't care too much about the real-time performance. But we did on the other one, which is why we went to 2.6. The picture, yeah, it's in full colour.
Why are you asking that?
as is the screen on this one. Yes, it's full colour. It's set up initially to run, the customer brief was 320 by 240 at 15 frames a second, or 640 by 320 at 4 frames a second, which is all we actually bothered to achieve. But with a bit of optimization, we know that we could improve that. And in fact, the customer has asked us about improving the performance now and increasing the resolution. The module that we've used is the same sort of camera module that you use in those little USB cameras, mobile phones, etc. A little CMOS image sensor, and it's capable of, you know, 1024 by 768. Any other questions? Sage? We have a full-time staff of 10, but we bring in consultants for example, for our industrial design. We have a partner in Brisbane who does our industrial design. We have partners for the manufacturing, and we bring in contractors for specific software-related components. So we've got two full-time guys on staff for Linux work. But embedded software development is a very broad field, and what we found is that we've gathered around us a bunch of contractors who have experience in a lot of different areas. I mean, this is the top-end 32-bit stuff, but we also do stuff down on 8-bit controllers, PICs and 8051s and MSP430s, all those sorts of things as well. And so we've got guys who are, you know, particularly specialised in those areas. So, you know, in full flight, you know, we could have 16-odd people in the office, as well as our external partners for things like industrial design and manufacturing. But as I said, that particular development was done in 7 months. This one here was from concept to the 120 build has just been finished. That was 12 months. So, you know, we concentrate on doing product development quickly. These are all custom designs. This is not take a board, bolt them together and make it go. This is starting from a blank piece of paper, and what you see there is a custom solution. Have I done my 15 minutes?
Yeah. Not that I'm proud of.
All right. Ian Walters.
Yeah. I think I'm going to keep the visualizer.
Well, you guys are going to have to get it working like this morning. I don't know what to do.
I'll shut down.
Yeah.
Get out of the way. I'll shut down and get out of the way.
No, that's all right. Maybe I'm going to just shut down. Yeah, I know. Let's wait until we see if some of this mess gets cleaned up. If it does, we don't really have to
use it.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to pick on you. Not much. No, it's not that good.
Yeah, we only in Slogger. Can we move this out? Thank you. Yeah, well, it worked this morning. I guarantee you it worked this morning because we can and tested it.
Okay, so anything new?
Yeah.
It's not something to me?
No.
Oh, cool.
Oh, there was something plugged into here this morning.
Was it?
Okay. Okay, then. What's it plugged into?
Anyway, there's you.
Yeah.
It's going to be rather disappointing without a visualizer.
Yeah. Here we go.
Excuse me, can you hold that? I'm going to need to actually.
Yep. Do you want me to clip it on you?
We've got some muscle tape to put on.
We've got a muscle you can clip it on, but you can't do it with one hand.
No, it's okay, Kathy.
So I clip it on.
I want my phone.
Next, can anyone hear you? Testing? Is that good? Yes, I'm not sure if the slides are going to work, but I'm going to start it up simply because it's got my notes on it.
Oh, he's working on that. I do like modelling work and stuff in my spare time, and I can show you all how to make a model green phone if you like, out of your little cards and your... Pretty easy. Things like plastic kit model.
Okay, getting there.
Fold it like that. It's your very own model green phone you can take home with you.
Yeah, this is a Mac.
They're cheap too.
Okay.
You say they don't run out of battery as fast though.
That's called
my Okay, so. Death from R. Okay, we're good. Okay, so basically this morning there was a talk on how you might develop for the green phone. This talk is going to more focus on some of the features you might want to take advantage of if you actually got the device. So just going through quickly, I'll be talking briefly about hardware features, software features, and some of the development tools that you'll have access to. So basically I'm just going to list this out because I'm not a hardware person. But you've got the LCD screen, you've got your 300, I'm sure people can read just as well as I can. Yeah, that's a touch screen. You know, tri-band, work around the world, Bluetooth.
I believe it is.
It's tri-band. That's what the information on the website says at the moment anyway.
Yeah, the first information I saw included the 850 band, I guess. That was a lie. That's fine.
I essentially copied that directly off our website.
Yep.
Okay, so some of the software you have access to. Basically, you have basic PIM data, the design of the PIM suite at a software level has a very strong separation between logic, e.g., accessing the data, writing it to disk, and the GUI, so you can pretty much rewrite the entire GUI with very little trouble. Even in the software level, there's certain accesses there so that you can easily add your own data sources for PIM. So at the moment, we've got a Google Calendar synchronization thing you can do in 4.2. That's there basically as a proof of concept, but if you have a look at that, you'll be able to see how easy it is to add your own data sources. There's also a fairly sophisticated content system. Basically, it's a user-oriented system, so it's not so much directories and file paths, but categories, metadata, that allow you to quickly search and find the right document out of potentially a very large number of documents. There's also support for digital rights management, although you don't have to turn it on if you don't want to. And you can add user-defined categorization, so, you know, contacts that you go to movies with frequently, events that are related to Linux contents, for example. There's Bluetooth. Oh, actually, I'm supposed to be flipping over to Reese every now and again so we can demonstrate some of this. Have you got the PIM stuff up? Okay, I'll flip over basically when he's got the PIM stuff up. You also have Bluetooth support. Okay, I'll just Okay, so PIM, basically, there's tools, it's rich text. This is the smooth scaling font you have in 4.2 in the 4.1 series. It's using bitmap font in 4.2. One of the things we've done is we've given it smooth scaling fonts and SVG icons. This basically means the device can easily scale its entire UI to any LCD resolution that you might end up getting. Okay, so back over to the information. So as I was saying, you've got Bluetooth. It uses the Bluetooth framework. Classes for negotiated connection. In 4.2, there's also a much more expanded set of Bluetooth profiles. I would be very surprised if there was a Bluetooth device that you couldn't get working. It's just a matter of how much code you might have to write. We've tried to write as much as we can to help support and take away the burden of that for you, though.
A lot of standard profiles like Headset and Hands-Free are there, but if you need to add a new profile, choose your thing for your own kind of Bluetooth thing, it's really easy to use that framework to do that.
Do you want the mic?
That was all I was going to say.
Oh, okay.
So has it got like OBEX and those sort of Bluetooth profiles?
Yes, we've got OBEX push. We've also got some basic printing via Bluetooth, so you can like print your pictures to if you take a picture with a camera, you can print it to a Bluetooth-capable printer that can do that. So.
Okay, so we find a lot of the customers for Qtopia phone basically don't want it to look like Qtopia. They want it to look like all their other phones. So there's extremely strong theming support in Qt. As I was saying before, in 4.2, we've got SVG support, screen DPI information, and one of the more interesting things is server widgets, which really allow you to make massive changes to the display. It takes a while to reboot, though. So I might just run forward again and come back to it. I should point out that what we're running over here is a development device. This is not a released version. This is code that's being pretty much developed right now. It hasn't actually even gone through code phase yet, so... You know.
So I might see it crash.
Yeah, you might see it crash. But the idea was just to show you some of the features that will be coming out soon, because we are releasing this very shortly, and I know a few people might be thinking about getting one.
I might note that this is actually my personal phone running here as well, so it's like we are actually eating our own dog food now on this stuff, which is something that was, for the first couple of years of Qtopia development, was a little bit difficult. But now with the green phone and hopefully the upcoming devices as well, we really are trying to push the experience forward ourselves so that we actually have a very good stack running on here that actually works in the field, rather than just shipping it off to someone in China who puts it on a phone and then goes, hang on, what happened?
Okay, so basically the standard launch is a grid, but this basically shows that you have not just the ability to change the bitmaps and pixmaps, but also how the icons are arranged and how the user would interact with it. I don't think we're suggesting this is a strong idea for an interface, but just shows you that you've got a lot more power than you normally have with most theming engines. You do have to write a little bit of code for that, but it is a very well-defined API, so you can just change the look and feel of it without actually having to worry too much about the logic of what you're interacting with. We also have software... back over to the computer. We also have a concept of software services. Those people at this morning's talk would have seen that in action. From a simple layer, it allows you to do things like creating new contacts and today viewing new tasks. But what you can also do is you can also transfer information back and cross between applications. For instance, there's a service provided by the camera application that says, give me a photo. This means that if you write another camera application and you think your application is better than the one on the phone already, you can actually replace that application, implement the service yourself. You can just go into that program, see your login. You don't have to load up a serial console in order to see what's happening in your application. It can also be useful if you're trying to do something else with the USB connection at the time.
We've got a pretty set of standard categories for a lot of the stuff that we've already got, but it's very easy to add your own login category to spit stuff out as well, turn it on and off. Well, very easy in a relative sense. Get there.
The latest BusyBox, when you compile up BusyBox and check the syslog applet, it will actually do the high-end syslog thing of being able to send your syslog messages over an internet connection. So if you're working on a development board that's got Ethernet, which a lot of them do, then you can actually syslog that stuff off to another machine and not worry about writing it to flash at all. And that actually works really, really well with this system because you can get really verbose messaging. You can store minutes, you know, hours of log and stuff. Yeah.
Okay, nearly finished. Back over to the computer. So, and one of the final development tools I'm going to mention, this is one of my personal favorites. There's an SQL console on the device. So basically one of the big features of Qtopia 4 is its back-end data storage for quite a lot of things is SQLite. This allows you to do more intelligent queries, better filtering. You're also not using up as much memory because the data stays on disk. You're not having to load it up into a data structure in memory to be able to interact with it. Having the SQLite console on the device basically allows you to inspect what data you think you've written to disk apart from the application. Qt also has some really nice classes for interacting with SQL. I don't know, how many people here were at Dunedin and went to my Qt tutorial? Well, if you remember correctly, I did a sample application and you would have seen exactly how easy it is to have a SQL table show up in your application. It's practically three lines of code at its simplest level. And that's about it. If you want any more information, that is an excellent place to start. There's like data sheets and there's the SDKs and so much information you wouldn't believe it. Any questions? Yeah, I think so. Okay, we're done.
'Cause we've got nothing. Go to Tim.
What, you really got nothing?
No, we've probably sold it today.
Yeah,
we've
got nothing. Yeah,
we've got
nothing. No, my suspenders in the field.
Right now.
One, two, three. No, I'm just booting. It's not even started yet. I, in theory, have flashy new X Windows that automatically picks up monitors and I don't have to reboot. Unfortunately, it doesn't suspend. Suspending, yeah. Well, it's a combination. We're just going to have a few slides on ways to sort of debug where you're suspending a Zoom field or file field, and then Matthew Garrett from Ubuntu, someone can annoy him and he'll... If you've got Ubuntu installed, he'll definitely fix it. If you don't have Ubuntu installed, he'll probably tell you to install Ubuntu and then fix it. Yes. Now I'm just beating up. There's a good chance my experimental driver won't work today. I can log in, so that's a good start. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. But I'm going to attempt to do this without editing my xorg.com. Yeah, it's a big, huge 1680 panel. It's not tiny. Quite bloody heavy. Something should come up. I've got one of 2 4x 7 6 8. Yeah. Rander 1.2, Keith.
It works.
Oh, no, it's still got a 1680 1050 panel. I'm just worried what will happen when I full screen this. It's probably not going to work, is it? So I won't. I'll just resize it nicely. All I have is some pictures. Oh, start recovery. Oh, well. I hope all I have is some pictures. Yeah, I've got the pictures. Yeah, your Rander sucks, dude. Oh, no. I'm a embedded software consultant in Sydney, and last 4 years I've been working for a company in Sydney called Stargames, out one of my work mixes here, far abroad. They make good old pokey machines. I never knew what one of those was before I came to Australia, but I got here and I found out they, funny enough, pokey machines are quite graphic things, and one of the few companies in Australia willing to pay me to sit and work on graphics was Stargames. So they basically design all their pokey machines currently we've been doing one for about 4 years now, design, and it's all based on Linux kernel. So it's all a 2.6 kernel. So they do a range of products using Linux in different places. So first slide I have. It's blurry, not because of the screen, it's because my hands are shaky. That board there is about the same size as a 3.5-inch board. So you're talking DA size, yeah, 10 by 15 centimeters. That board's got a Pentium M 1.5, an 852 chipset. It's got compact flash, it's got DVI, VGA, 4 USB, Ethernet. I think pretty much every connector you can get is, you know, it's pretty much Intel chipset 852 with everything on it. It's that size. We're currently trying to use that for, we have gaming terminals. So you've got a blackjack table or a craps table, one of those American games, and you've got little small terminals. We're trying to use that board because it's the smallest thing we can get that runs the system. So we're going to be running that with probably just a standard, I'd say it'll be 2620 when it comes out, or maybe 21, because we want to get, this board has one major problem. It's got really bad memory bandwidth. And for doing 3D graphics, you really want memory bandwidth. So it loses a bit on that. So we're trying to use this new DRM memory management that the kernel guys, or Tungsten Graphics, have been doing for the last while, which reduces the memory usage by not shuffling as much data around and things like that. So it's fairly experimental code, and we're trying to get it up to speed and running onto this board, hopefully in the next month. So as part of that, it'll be merged into the kernel, because it's also what I do other times. So that board is one of the current systems. This is the inside of a poker machine. In case anyone's never seen one, Farbod, you probably want to avert your eyes. in that box with the big lock. And that's just for the notes. The cache goes down here underneath it all. But that's pretty much a standard LPD. But in here we've got this cage, metal logic cage. And inside in this cage is where all the CPUs, this cage has to be lockable and all that, and there's a lot of sensors on it to make sure no one tampers with it. The power goes out and somebody opens it, it has to record it. There's an awful lot of little security features that are required. This stuff in here is just the crap that's inside my machine. No. The machine is electrostatically tested, but not in terms of, not RF. So, no. So this is the main board we have in the system. This is a 915 Intel chipset. This is a Pentium M Celeron 915. This isn't so embedded, except it is. It's industrial embedded systems. This is like a half of gig of RAM, and we have machines with a gig of RAM, put it that way. So we're not exactly memory constrained, except for the guys who design our games want to do a lot of graphics. So you get them doing things like full screen, 1024 by 768, 25 frames a second, 20 second animation using PNGs. Believe you me, you need memory and lots of it. The previous design, which we ever actually released, was based on the similar system. This was based on the 810, but we didn't get it. We had too many. This motherboard's off-the-shelf Taiwanese bought. We actually designed our own x86 motherboard in-house. I think we're the only company in Australia who ever been stupid enough to try that. It's hard. It was really hard. I know somebody was saying from Sage that you can get boards built in Australia. That's fine if you're getting boards with speeds like that. Do not try and do an x86 motherboard without Taiwanese help. I can guarantee it will not work, or you will not get it. Yeah, you wouldn't get it working either. I believe you me, we talk to everybody. So it's mainly to do with the front side bus. You're talking 500-600 megahertz. Nobody can get it right here. So, we went to Taiwan. Pardon? Lex? No. Yeah, no, we've got so many Taiwanese companies. You thought this is the main board that we run off. This is just standard off-the-shelf system. Somebody stole my BIOS chip, I just noticed. This is the inside of the logic cage, the way it fits. So there's a board down the back here. It's a backplane. That's the main board I showed you there now. Slotted vertically down into it. This is the next board I'll show you, which is an I.O. board. There's a couple of compact flash adapters here plugged in off IDE. Another big problem we've noticed, whenever you buy a board off anybody, Taiwanese for some reason, they'll put a compact flash adapter on the board. They'll forget to wire up the DMA pin, so you'll have to go and build your own compact flash adapter somewhere else, because you'll stick a DMA flash in it and Linux won't boot unless you turn off DMA. It's one pin. I don't know how the hell, but they always forget it. This board actually has two Ethernet ports, which is quite unusual. We've got one to talk to our own network. We've one to talk to the government, to some say. They're a bit paranoid. They don't like us doing two things. So we originally designed only with one because we thought that's all we'll need. But no, they've sort of said they don't use it currently, but in the future they want a private Ethernet port. This board contains 14 serial ports, this system. Now, so two Ethernet ports and 14 serial ports is quite a lot of connectivity. The government is very, you've got a lot of stuff we have to connect to. Firewall will tell you. We connect to an awful lot of government systems, and they all use really crazy protocols that they design themselves. Every state in Australia is different. Every country around the world is different. So you need different types of serial ports for different things. You need 16550s, you need 9-bit multi-drops, you need RS-485. It's just, so you have to give this massive array of things. Also into this board, you have to plug in all the components in the box. So this thing here is a validator for notes. There's a touchscreen for this guy. Let's see what else is plugged into that. There's a ticket printer that will be down here. And these are all serial, so you just have to have an awful lot of serial ports. I think we've got a couple spare now because we overspec'd, but all's better than more than little. So this is the interface board then between that system, our main x86 Linux system and all the I.O. It's got an FPGA, which has loads of serial ports and a MicroBlaze soft processor in it. Unfortunately, we're not running Linux on the MicroBlaze, but that's only because we've only got something like, is it 64K RAM when you left? 256K RAM, I think. So yeah, it wasn't worth it. It's a simple design. Mark used to work for us at the time and did it, the code in it. And all this is more serial ports over here. These are special Philips chips, pretty crap. This up here is a battery-backed RAM. So we actually have to store RAM, so if the power goes, we've got to store whatever has been happening in the machine for the last while. If the power supply, we have got a power supply that tells us when the power goes, and then we've got like 250 milliseconds to clean up. So we rely on the fact that our power supply is going to hold the machine up for 250 milliseconds while we clean up all the stuff in the background, so that if the machine goes down, we can bring it back up exactly where it was, doing the exact same thing, so that players don't lose any money or players don't get any issues with it. And these batteries have to last them crazy, like 10 years. So, but this board, yeah, was a design done in Australia, designed, but built over in Taiwan because, well, it's in the big cage. So this system, this is your standard poker machine you'll get, and, well, hopefully we'll start selling them pretty soon. It's actually quite standard now across all poker machine companies, the 915 chipset. It seems to become the standard issue used for this. Some people run Windows. I think more and more people are going to run Linux because Windows is very, it's easier to get started, it's harder to get finished, I think is what this people have been saying. You'll get up to speed, you'll get your graphics a lot quicker, but you will get a lot of problems doing your low-level timings and your real-time. We're not running any special real-time on this. It's pretty much, I think the current system is a 2.6.16. We've added a few kernel patches to do things, but we have to do a background CRC check of every executable program in the system constantly. So if the code happens to change, we have to notice it and shut the machine down for security reasons. So this involves a lot of VM hacking in the kernel to try and catch. You got to do the kernel, all the modules for the kernel, and all the applications that are running. So anything that has a text segment has to be continuously CRC'd in the background to make sure that the machine hasn't been tampered with. So it's quite a lot of pain. This is another board that this system is here. Above that monitor, if you've seen a lot of poker machines, there's another monitor. Lately, the people started using two monitor systems. Currently in our system, the top monitor is run from this little i810, i815 chipset, pretty old, pretty powerless, but it consumes an awful lot of watts. And what we mainly use that top board for is just playing movies, just little movies, little MPEGs, little application, I think it scrolls up a jackpot number, things like that, nothing too intense. So we decided that little box is taking a lot of power and it's costing us a lot of money. So we want to use an embedded processor that can do movies, VGA style. So we've picked out this board. This is not the board we're going to use. This is the development board. We have actually a start. Just not enough memory bandwidth. When you're doing 1024768 PNGs, memory band. If I had, the docs key for the MPEG encoder on the 915, it might help me. Huh? Well, it would help for other things because but pretty much we're not CPU limited. We use something like 20% of a Celeron. Yeah, so that would probably be helpful. We use a lot of compressed textures as well if we have to. But no, I don't think so either. I could reverse engineer it and then make you release it. So this board here is a TI, DaVinci. They're pretty much, this is the chip here. The board we want to build with this chip on it is possibly about this size. We don't really need the rest of it. All I have to do is have VGA DVI out, so either DVI digital or a VGA output, and it has to play movies at 1024x768 16-bit color. And it has to do overlay. So this chip pretty much covers everything we want. It's got two videos frame buffer overlays. Oh, I'm running out of battery. And it's got two 16-bit with 3-bit alpha that you can put on top of the overlay. 3-bit alpha for the win. So we want to basically take this board and cut it down as small as possible, just put a compact flash on it, USB on it, plug it into the board, and have it run all our movies. TI have just launched this. This board here only does 720p, and it only does composite video. So we can't use it for VGA yet. We're waiting on part for them to design. They've designed the board, but we've not been able to get it to function. TI themselves have said they can't get the board to do 1080i, but they're trying, but some of their downstream. When we say cheap, I think they want to cut this completely down because the current box is they'll cut as much as they can out of it. So yeah, this is actually quite an interesting board. This runs, I think it's like TI's OMAP processor. So you're running the same sort of thing as you would in mobile phones, that Linux OMAP system. The frame buffer is fairly It has some small bandwidth problems as well, but they're not quite as bad. So we're trying. This has only started recently, this project, so it will be interesting to see. But it just gives you, we sort of span the range from small embedded, deep, these sort of projects to, yes, 1 gig of memory embedded. So.
Yeah.
That's all I've got slides. I only had 6 pictures. So if anyone has any questions, then. I've been working there 4 years and I've been asked that question a lot. And the only answer I've ever had to that question is, will I be here? I'd be on a very nice beach.
PQI make a flash IDE device. So instead of using those CF adapters and everything?
Yeah, we actually used one from, oh God, who was it, ST or something, Pacer, an ATA flash IDE.
Terrible.
Really expensive. Reasonably,
cheap.
Yeah, the reason we're using compact flash at the moment is price point. It's 512 megs of flash, costs you nothing because it's so common, it's in every other device.
But I had a huge amount of problems with them corrupting on me under Linux.
Well, we don't write to these. We're not allowed. In fact, one of the things we're currently haven't finished designing is where do we have two compact flash adapters? We're going to put a CPLD onto the IDE bus between the main processor and the flash adapter so we can guarantee that they're write protected for New South Wales government. Some Queensland are like, yeah, don't worry about that. That we want to write to the flashes. But places like New South Wales are like, we need this. We need this. So we have to adapt. We actually do need to put a CPLD on that to do these sort of extra tricks they want. So we'd only, we would. I wanted to use them, but it's just been price. Yeah. All right.
Whatever. Everyone gets it wrong. I don't have any slides or anything, but I've got notes. I'm going to be talking about the Neuros OSD. I'm not affiliated with Neuros in any way, so whatever I say is my opinion, blah, blah, blah. So what this device is... Oh, sorry. Okay. So what this device is basically a media box. What it can do is it can plug it into your TV, and you can record stuff. You can play back movies, sound, whatever. As for storage, it takes media cards. It's got USB, so it can take USB mass storage devices, you know, whatever. It also has a network port, which currently they're working on doing interesting stuff with that. It runs Linux, obviously, otherwise I wouldn't be talking about it. The hardware inside, it runs a TI DM320, which is like a dual-core chip that has an ARM9 processor running at 200 megahertz or something like that. And the other core is a DSP, which you can upload firmware to. And that's what actually does most of the video encoding and decoding stuff, because the CPU wouldn't be able to handle it. It can handle a variety of codecs like MPEG-4 and so on. Has 32 megs of SD RAM and 8 megs flash. And I believe Rafterman was complaining about the flash because he wants more. Okay, so it takes composite and NS video in. It only does composite out, unfortunately. It takes stereo in and out. It has an IR receiver. It comes with a little fairly standard remote control for controlling it. It also has an IR blaster, which is basically a little IR LED on the end of a long cable. And what you can actually do is you can make it turn your TV on, you know, change the channel and start recording automatically and then shut off after a certain amount of time. It has obviously a serial port, which is required for development pretty much. And obviously it has a network port. I've got it set up to do TFTP booting, so it just pulls off images off the TFTP server so I can mess around with it. It does USB host. It takes mass storage devices. They wrote their own USB drivers for this, and they don't really support anything beyond mass storage devices. I kind of hacked at the USB driver a little bit. I don't know anything about kernel development, but I managed to get like a mouse going and stuff like that, which was pretty hacky, and I'm pretty sure I didn't do it right. Card slots. So it has, it can take SD memory sticks, like the memory stick duos and the pros and whatnot. XMMC cards. It's got a big compact flash slot, so it can take compact flash cards or micro drives or whatever. I believe it's a full PCMCIA slot, so you might be able to run Wi-Fi cards off of it. I'm not sure about that. And a lot of people just throw in an external USB hard drive because that offers the most storage, basically. It runs 2.6. I can't remember which version, but they have implemented a lot of drivers for various things. It has they use proprietary kernel modules for the DSP at the moment. There's some work being done on that to get them fully open source at TI. And I think they got stuff from a company called Ingent, or I can't remember exactly, but they just gave them the drivers and everything. It's like, here you go, sir. So they're closed source at the moment. That's all the video codecs and stuff like that. Some of the audio codecs actually do get decoded on the CPU because the CPU can't handle it. So the main app that runs on it is a completely custom app. It's a simple menu-based app, basically allows you to select, you know, recording and stuff like that. Lets you configure the device as far as, you know, standard time settings, you know, network setup and stuff like that. Unfortunately, I think, like, in my opinion, the software isn't quite there yet. So I think they released a little bit too early, but it's getting there. Their custom user interface runs on, I think, NanoX or TinyX or something along those lines. They use their own custom widgets and UI and stuff like that. It's all driven by infrared. The infrared remote control actually sends keystrokes to the application. And the main application handles all the hardware and stuff. So, like, you plug in a card and stuff, and it's gets notified and it brings it up and it mounts it for you and everything, and you can just navigate to it and stuff. So there's a development environment you can grab that lives in SVN. It's updated quite regularly. It's worked on a lot. There's sort of one big build script. It's kind of hacked together. They're currently working on improving a dev environment, so to basically allow people to get into it more easily. Basically, Neuros, I saw this online on ThinkGeek, and I thought, this could be a fun little project to play around with. And it is really fun. Like, just if you want to play with something embedded, it's pretty fun to play with. The thing that struck me about Neuros is how open they are. Like, they really talk to the community. They're really involved. They listen to what people in the community say. Like, we were having discussions on, you know, development processes and stuff like that over IRC. And several key community members have, like, commit access to their main SVN repository and stuff, so they're really involved. The owner of Neuros actually goes on IRC as well, so you can chat to him if you want. They also have mailing lists and a wiki and all that sort of stuff. They hold weekly meetings where you can talk to the head of their firmware department, so you can, you know, make suggestions, or they'll discuss problems that they're having and stuff like that with the community. You know, they're quite open about issues that they're having. Like, if they're stuck on something, they'll reach out and, you know. They do have bounties for various things. Like, one of the bounties is to implement, like, a YouTube browser. There are a few other bounties to do other sorts of stuff, which is pretty cool. They're really open about the hardware as well. Like, they'll write down exactly what they're doing, what sort of hardware they're looking at. They'll take suggestions as to what hardware people want. So what's sort of we're heading towards changing a few things. Like, we're looking at getting the toolchain running with Scratchbox, so we can do development using Scratchbox, because that's would probably be much easier if people can just download an image or a table or something and just start getting into writing apps for this thing. Neuros have someone contracted under NDA with TI to actually write an open source bridge for the DSP chip. So hopefully we're going to be able to have open source codecs basically running on this DSP. And I believe he's gotten it to a point where he can actually upload and execute code on the DSP, which is pretty cool. A lot of people, so Neuros is also going to use this DM320 platform in their future devices. They're working on, I believe it's called the Neuros 3 or something. It's their next portable player. And it's going to be based around the same platform, and it's going to run, you know, similar stuff. So a lot of people actually bought the OSD solely for that reason, so they could get into the development, push Neuros in the right direction in terms of software and the way they're doing things, and to really get into development of their next device. And they're currently working out the hardware, you know, what sort of stuff they should do, and they're looking at using quality components. And I hear something that people can really write apps for and play around with. They're currently finishing up sort of the main software that runs on the OSD as well. They're improving it a bit. There's one guy in the community who got, like, you know, he got Samba running on it, and they included that in the main firmware because that was cool. And he's actually gotten, he's doing some Qtopia stuff. He's gotten Qt4 or something running on it. I don't know what he's doing. He's written his own little player thing, which is crazy. So Neuros, like, it's cool what they're doing. Like, they're being totally open completely about this. So that's just what gets me about it, and that's why I had to tell you all about it today. That's about it. There's a website, open.neurostechnology.com. is sort of the main thing. I can write it on the board if you want.
On the
wiki, I'll put it on the wiki. Okay. They have an IRC channel, Freenode, like #Neuros or #Neuros over there. I can't remember which one it is. And they've got mailing lists as well on a wiki and stuff. Yep.
I might have missed this at the start, but how much is it?
Crap, I can't remember. Yeah. There you go. They're selling it at ThinkGeek, which I think is the only place that will actually ship it overseas. They sell it directly, but only ship in the US, and I believe American Tech sell it. I don't know where they ship to.
It's very similar to the embedded device that I bought.
Yeah, it sounds very similar to an embedded device that I bought for the same reason, to have a play around with it.
Yeah, it's very much a hacker's toy.
Yeah, it sounds similar, like it's an all-in-one chip, like you said, with
two arms. Yeah, just system on chip sort of deal.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool. Oh, it has presets for like encoding for portable devices like an iPod or a PSP. So you can go, okay, I want to record for a PSP. You plug your PSP's memory stick into it. You record a TV show. And then when it's done, you just unplug it, plug it into your PSP and play it. Any more questions? Cool.
G'day. We were going to do a short talk here, but we've actually got to go. I'm Hugo Vincent, this is John Towers. We're with the Albatross UAV project. What this basically is an embedded Linux system that sits inside an aircraft and basically acts as an all-inclusive autopilot. We've got some hardware here. We're actually doing a talk about it on Wednesday morning, so if any of you are interested in embedded Linux, especially on ARM, about real-time issues, about software development, about aircraft design, about flight simulators, please come along to our talk on Wednesday morning. Thanks.
Hey, do you want to take a break for a few minutes, or do you want to keep going?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Probably more likely going to be 15 minutes, please. Take a break for 10 minutes. All right. Mitch, you're next.
Hello, my name is Mitch Davis. Hey! I work for Open Networks in Melbourne, and this is an ADSL 2-pass modem, which I'll take the cover off in a moment. Open Networks, as well as making install software for PCs to make it easy for people to connect to ADSL, also provide modems now to 9 of the top 20 ISPs in Australia. So if you go along to get ADSL service from iNet, iPrivus, Westnet, FTEL, WildIT, and a couple of weeks ago we picked up Internode. So if you go to Internode and ask for ADSL service, what you'll get is one of our Open Networks modems. What's inside it is a chip from TI, and like Michael's one there, it's a dual core chip. One of the cores is a DSP to do the ADSL work. And the other core is a MIPS processor to do the management features. It has 2 megabytes of ROM and 8 megabytes of flash. That's the low-end model. Our models we're going to be releasing this month have 4 times that memory. What I'd like to talk about today is the process of releasing open source software. So people here who've put out products that are based on Linux have the obligation for the open source parts to publish those modifications. And what I'll be talking about today is some ideas that can help in fulfilling those legal obligations that we have in publishing source code. The software that's inside it is a mixture of, comes on 3 levels. The kernel at the bottom is a 2.4.17 kernel. On top of that, in the middle layer, is the runtime library and applications such as PPP Daemon, DHCP, IP tables, HTTPD, BusyBox,
whole bunch of usual kind of open source programs. The third layer on the top of that is proprietary configuration manager written by TI that provides an HTML web interface, SNMP, Cisco-like CLI, and TI69. Now, of course, some of the parts of this we have to publish, the GPL and the LGPL parts. Some of the parts we may publish, a lot of it is under BSD license, and there are certain parts of it which we may not publish because they're proprietary. The problem we've got is that we have 25,000 lines of source code, which is a combination of all three of these all mixed together. So when it comes to publishing, we've got to find a way that we can pull together this mess of 25,000 files into the open source parts and the proprietary parts. Certain things that we can't publish are the configuration manager, the HTML files that go along with that, that has the validation that runs on the client's browser, the JavaScript stuff, and also the embedded query language that embedded in the HTML that does a lot of the formulation of the results that they see on the screen. We can't release the internal file system of the modem. It's not GPL, I'm talking about a Tetra and VARPIN and all this kind of stuff. We also can't release the source code for the wireless drivers, the USB drivers, and the ATM drivers. They're binary modules. Legal status of binary modules aside, we're not allowed to release the source code for those. But the rest of it, we can and should be able to release the source code for it. At the moment, what I'm talking about here is a little bit of vaporware, because this is something we're just starting doing. We haven't published source code yet. We've put together a lot of ideas on how to do that, but I'm also soliciting feedback from people on how we can balance a couple of things that I'll get to later. So it's a bit of two-way. What most companies do, you look at companies like D-Link, Linksys, Netcom, generally what they do, unless they really get a lot of pressure applied to them, is that they'll take their source tree, when they're under pressure to do a source release, they'll take their source tree, they'll delete all the proprietary parts, and then shove it on their website. It's not compilable, and it doesn't include all of the things that you need to be able to take that source code, compile it up, and produce something that you can then, that is actually useful for putting on a modem. I think you should be able to take the source code, mix it in with the proprietary stuff, and get an image exactly the same as what you got when you got the modem. I'll come back to that in a moment. So one of the reasons they don't release often is because it's hard work. It's hard work to take this big body of source code, start stripping out all the proprietary stuff, not making mistakes which are going to reveal partners' intellectual property while still fulfilling both the letter and the spirit of the GPL. There are two things we're kind of doing. So look, for our first release, what we're planning to do is take the source code, do what everybody else does, delete the proprietary bits, shove it on a website. But the problem is that it's just as hard to do that next time. What can we do to make it easier next time? One of the thoughts that I'm having is that you can view most of these open source packages as a set of changes that have been applied over time. You take a package, for example, the kernel. Once upon a time, it started life as a pristine tarball. Then it went to Monte Vista. Monte Vista added a series of changes. Then TI added a series of changes, and we at Open Networks have added more changes to it. So what you get is an aggregation of patches that have been applied to this software to produce something that that is actually in the modem for the end user. So what we're proposing to do is separate out those changes that we've made into a patch that was made by this organisation, a patch that was made by that organisation, a patch that was made by that organisation. And then what we're planning to do is use the Quilt tool. Does anyone here use Quilt? Quilt. It's a pretty handy tool. A lot of kernel developers use it for tracking changes that are made to their source code. They can get a patch from this guy, a patch from that guy, a patch from that guy. Quilt not only automatically applies the patches to base source code, but if you then go and modify that base source code, it will also go back to the patches and keep the patches up to date. So we're hoping by using the Quilt tool that we can keep patches that we publish on our website up to date. So then on the day that we do a binary release for a particular customer, we should be able to push a button, Quilt goes to work, and generates a new set of patches so that we're always up to date with the source code. And I think people here who have to publish source code for open source parts of their products, possibly in a similar sort of situation. So what we're having to do with Quilt is make it so that it's repeatable. What we want to do on top of that, because there are certain things that we can't publish. We can't publish TI's top-level makefile that descends into all the packages. So what that means is that you can get the open source parts, but it's like a whole bunch of parts. There's nothing to tie it all together. There's nothing to generate an image. There's nothing to help you put it onto a board. So while there's been a compliance with the letter of the GPL, there's nothing with the spirit of the GPL that you should have the freedom to take software, make your own modifications, and run it. So what we hope to do is not just release the source code for the open source stuff, but also provide a definitive tool chain to use, provide a top-level executive makefile that's going to be able to coordinate the building of all the open source packages. But even if you did compile all these open source packages, what you're going to get is the bottom of those two layers. You're going to get the kernel up and running, and you're going to get the middle packages, but you're still not going to have the management top. You're not going to have the web interface. You're not going to have the some of the other stuff that TI adds. And you look at projects such as OpenWRT. They've capitalized off the kernel work. They've capitalized off the middle work, but they also don't have very mature web interfaces at the moment because it's really hard to do. Our idea is to write a tool. We can't distribute the TI proprietary configuration manager. But when you think about it, every modem that we ship to our customers already has a binary copy of the configuration manager in it. And the same goes with all the HTML that's in that drives the user interface. So what we're planning to do, and we've got some test stuff that does this, so it's not ready for release yet. What we're planning to do is get a program which connect your modem to the PC. It will suck out all those proprietary bits out of the modem onto your PC so that then when you've compiled all the open source parts, join the two together, give yourself an image exactly the same as what the modem was shipped with, put back on the modem. Or you can extend the open source parts and make yourself a better image. And we think that complies with the spirit of the GPL as well as the letter of the GPL. So the two things we're looking at doing are repeatability, to make it easy to do releases in the future, to keep us compliant, and also utility. We want to produce something which is useful for people to use. That's our plan. One of the problems with it is that you look at projects such as OpenWRT. The kernel we've got in there is based on 2.4.17. OpenWRT are based on 2.6 point something, and they've got all their own packages on top of it. I'm wondering, we have to publish to be compliant with the license, but are people going to care about seeing our source code? Do people want the source code exactly as it is on the modem? So, a bit of an open question, what do people want to see? And that's about it. With a mic. Do you have another mic? Yeah, okay, I'll repeat the question. Thomas?
Once you have your own tool chain that you're willing to release, would you even bother still using the proprietary top-level makefile and the proprietary tool?
The tool chain being, the question is, if we bothered releasing the tool chain, would you be bothered running your own?
You're saying you can't release the top-level makefile, for example.
Yeah.
But you want to release something that will give the end user the equivalent so they can make the exact same binary image.
Yeah.
If they can do it, you can do it.
When you say they, who's they? You're saying end users or TI?
If you manage to get it to the point where somebody can go to a web page and download everything, get exactly the same image,
then in theory you could do the same thing without having to use that proprietary make file in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get rid of it and you don't have to strip it out anymore.
There's a larger question here. Why don't we go with something like OpenWRT? The software's a lot newer. We can rely on the open source community for their input. The problem is that we rely on TI for updates for the ADSL drivers and the wireless drivers and the web interface and a mature web interface. We have to track fairly closely what TI does. We can't report problems to TI. We've put thousands of man hours into improving the reliability of this. You get the same hardware if you buy a modem from Netcom, but they don't have local engineering ability, and that's why ISPs are coming to us, because we've put thousands of man hours into fixing defects in it. We have to track fairly closely what TI are doing, continue to use their systems if we're going to get support from TI. And it's managing that, making our deviations from TI in terms of our improvements, making that deviation manageable. So we do have to track what they do fairly closely.
A quick one, a bit of a hornet's nest here, I think.
Who's been involved in the process of publishing source code for their company? But you're all here because you're interested in embedded Linux. And there's a lot of not publishing happening. It's a hard problem.
Embedded,
it's hard to do well.
Embedded doesn't imply not published, though.
Sorry?
Embedded does not imply unpublished. If it's embedded and it's open source, then there's a requirement to publish.
Yeah. What usually happens is the companies put their proprietary value add on the top of it, and their only obligation is to publish the source code for the open source stuff. We understand that.
With provisions, but I won't go into the details right now. Just a quick question, the question I was going to originally ask before that was brought up. The question is, the stuff that you've got that is open source, under which license? Is it GPL? Which stuff do you have?
We have a table here if you're interested. The kernel is GPL. The runtime library is LGPL. That's UC Libc. About half of the helper applications in the middle, like DHCP, things like that, are GPL. And about half of them are under some variant of the BSD license, for instance, MIT. PPP stuff under the CMU license, it's a variant of BSD. We're not obliged to publish those, but we certainly will. Any reason to hold back on it.
Want to use those man hours to make more open hardware, and then you've got more open software.
Because what we want to do, okay, it's not my company. I'm just an engineer, senior engineer. What we want to do is sell modems to ISPs. So we've got to think about where we put our resources, and we can, when we think of the market that we really want to serve, the reason why nobody knows our name, Open Networks, is because we're not targeting end users, we're not targeting hobbyists, we're targeting ISPs who then supply our modems to their end users. So we have to put our investment dollars into targeting that market, the ISPs, and they're not interested in open hardware. Yeah.
So are your ISPs actually rebranding your products, or does this open network product?
Some of them do. Most of them ship it just as it is. Some of them ask for custom modifications. Some of them ask them to be locked to their network because they're selling them under price. But most of them ship it with open networks. Like if you go to the InterNode website and have a look at the modems that they have available, it's our modems with our brand on it.
You can also look on Broadband Choice or something like that, on WorldBill or something.
Yeah, yep. The open modems are, you can say that I've got a modem.
I've seen other companies that are doing the same as you, and it seems that the biggest problem seems to be TI, with their licensing. For example, Broadcom seems to be a little better. Have you thought about ditching TI and going for some other provider of the hardware?
You're starting to talk areas of strategic direction and marketing, whereas I can only do engineering things and pass on and make sure that it's understood in the company that we have legal requirements. As far as open source goes, TI don't get it. I don't know about Michael's experiences with DSP bridge stuff. All they're interested in doing is shipping chips. To them, software is a cost center that if they had their way, they wouldn't do, because what they want to do, they're a hardware company, they want to ship chips.
So aren't you afraid that one of your customers, one of the telcos, finds out that what you're shipping is actually illegal because of TI, and that they are going to ditch you and your losing customers?
You look at talks by people like Evan Moglen, and they say they would much rather work on compliance than suing people. You look at the work that Harold Zelta has done with his GPLviolations.org program. They're much more interested in seeking compliance than suing people. Evan Moglen says, I go to a company, the first thing I say is, I don't want your money. He says, the second thing I say is, we don't want publicity. We just want you to comply. So ISPs come to us because we can give them the product and we can respond when they say there's a problem or they say it needs to be tailored to their particular market, we can respond. ISPs don't care so much for the license. All they want is a product. I just have to fulfill my responsibility as an engineer to make sure the legals get covered.
I just wanted to say, Mitch, thanks for raising this really important issue.
Thanks for raising this really important issue, and your idea of being able to rebuild an identical binary from the sources and from the binaries that are sucked out from the ship device is a really good idea. I think it would be very valuable for the open source community. I think it's an idea that could be written into open source licenses and used as a tool for education of companies to see open source as a an opportunity to take but maybe not to give back. So good on me for raising it.
Thank you. I would hope that with some of these issues and some of the techniques that we're proposing to solve some of these problems, why companies don't release or don't release more often, I would hope to make it so that these techniques became more well known and so that it became so easy for companies to do releases that it just became second nature and we'd see a lot more released source code. Thank you.
Thank you. Not only are you guys getting the first